Hello and welcome back to General Chat. Today's guest is a Twitch partner, cosplayer, and self-employed creative. She makes beautiful outfits and is an equally beautiful soul. Please welcome onto the cast, Serafita. Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. I was so excited to have you on because I've been watching for this, you know, the past couple weeks you've been doing your cosplay Twitch streams, and I've been so enamored with those, so I'm glad that you got to come on.
Well, I'm glad you've been enjoying them. I really love, like, streaming my cosplay progress. It helps keep me motivated to work on it, so glad you're enjoying it.
Well, I imagine, because there's so much detail that goes in. For instance, not on this particular outfit, but the outfit you were doing before this, there was a skirt that you were doing that had beading on it, but just like all this detailed beading on the bottom, and that takes so much time.
Yeah, Blood Queen Lanethel. I'm still working on her a little bit, but she's somewhat paused right now, so I can concentrate more on my Black Ice Jaina Proudmoore costume. But I do plan on going back and working on Lanethel some more, because I have about 1,000 beads finished, and I need a few thousand more on there.
Whew. I'm sweating just thinking about beading a few thousand beads.
I mean, I've done a costume that had almost 8,000 beads before, so it's not too bad. It's very relaxing, because, you know, you just kind of, like, just keep going and going and going, and it's not really monotonous, but it's soothing in its own way.
Which outfit was that had all that beading on it?
That was a Blood Queen Lanethel designed by my friend Zach Fisher. I am going to keep working on it, especially more after I finish Jaina, since there's just some things on it that I need to kind of figure out.
Oh, I can't wait to see that. It's going to be gorgeous. Do you think you can tell us a little bit about Black Ice Jaina, where that design came from?
Yeah, sure. The design came from my friend Zach Fisher, who, as I mentioned, designed my Blood Queen Lanethel. It's part of a group cosplay of over 100 cosplayers for BlizzCon called Project Ebonblade. It started as the brainchild of Zach, Chad Hoku of Hoku Props, a few of our other mutual friends, and they were like, hey, Zach, wouldn't it be cool to reimagine all these Warcraft characters as Death Knights? And, you know, just reimagine Bolvar, and, like, he's just, like, recruiting and amassing this huge army to take over Azeroth. Or just, like, a what if, you know, we hadn't defeated Arthas, or actually we would have had to defeat Arthas anyway. You know, what if Bolvar decided to do this? And so, like, we have Sarah. We have two incarnations of Jaina. We have Illidan, I think we have Malfurion. We have the Four Horsemen from the Death Knight Class Hall campaign. And it's a huge project. We have the Archerist Death Guard as well, who are not so much nameless, but more role-style characters. And he's going to do, like, six designs of that. So you can pick and choose different elements from each design to do whichever one you want.
And this has its own Twitter, right? Because I've been seeing some beautiful artwork of that, and that's how I first saw it, like, in my Twitter feed, of the gorgeous artwork that's been done all under, you know, the helm Project Ebonblade. And so I was really intrigued when I saw from that people were doing cosplay.
Yes, all of the artwork is being designed by Zach, and I'm actually the one who runs the Project Ebonblade Twitter. I'm the face behind the voice over there. I'm having a lot of fun with it too. I just kind of like, okay, you know, get in that kind of evil mindset. You're Bolvar, you're a Lich King. Show off, like, your generals and all your different leaders and characters that you're amassing now. So let's go. Let's have fun with this.
That's been really entertaining. What is the handle for that Twitter so people can check it out?
The handle is Proj Ebonblade. Projebonblade, because Project Ebonblade was a little too long, so had to shorten it.
Well, and I'll link that down below as well so you guys can go check it out. So we've talked a bit about Jaina and Project Ebonblade, and I think that people can start to suspect that I might know you from the WoW community. How did you get involved in playing World of Warcraft?
It started in 2005, almost a year after it came out. I started playing November 8th. I actually, a couple of years ago, went onto my Battle.net account to look up the exact date that I started playing. There was this guy who lived in the dorm down the hall from me, college, and I thought he was kind of cute. And he would talk about this game, World of Warcraft, and we became friends. And so I would like sit there, I would hang out in his dorm room 3 or 4 nights a week and just raid in Molten Core, and I just thought it was so cool because I had never really played a game like it.
Does that mean when it came time to get the giant statues that you were one of the recipients of those amazing statues?
Alas, no, I missed that cutoff. Although a friend of mine sent me one of hers because she and her husband each got one. So she had
Oh,
two. She's like, here, you can have my second one.
that's so sweet.
It was. It's now sitting on top of my desk.
Well, I saw recently that you were able to get some of the auction items from the Warcraft movie. Can you tell me a little bit about that and what that was all about?
Oh my gosh, I did. The prop store in LA and London was tends to auction off a lot of movie props, and there was a huge announcement that there was going to be a Warcraft movie prop sale, and like, okay, let's see what's going to be available. And so I ended up purchasing a Culturan shield, Culturan banner, Elven banner, and Medivh's glass and pitcher set, which was in the movie.
So, did your choices have any particular significance to you? Like, did you really want the Elven or Culturian sets for any particular reason?
Yes, I love elves. I've always loved elves since I started playing WoW. Actually, since before I started playing WoW, back in like middle school when I read Lord of the Rings, I've always had a thing for elves. And I play a mage, and Jaina is my favorite Warcraft character. So having the culture and pieces just kind of a lot to me as somebody who really connects with Jaina and mage.
And those pieces were all really beautiful and not like little dinky props the way you would think maybe a movie prop would be. They look really good quality. You must be really proud to have them.
I am so excited to have them. I plan on getting the two banners, shadow box framed professionally and hanging them up in my house. And the pitcher and glass set will be in like a display case, but I might use it once in a while for like a prop or something. And the shield will be hung in my bedroom.
Yeah, you know, when you have guests over or the blood of your enemies, whichever.
Yeah, it's only two glasses, so it might just be more of like a photo prop than if I have any friends over, but it'll get some use.
Well, so you talked about liking elves earlier in your life in high school and middle school. When did you start getting into geekery, into nerdery?
Oh, I pretty much came out of the womb like immersed in it. My mom introduced me to the Chronicles of Narnia series when I was about 9 years old. That was when I read it, and I was in like fourth grade. And that was also when I read The Hobbit. I watched the original BBC movies, the original cartoon versions of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And I used to watch Doctor Who reruns as a kid with my parents, as well as Twilight Zone, the original Superman, the original Batman, just like that stuff. Like, that's what I grew up on.
Is that something that you can still bond with your parents over? Because that stuff still exists. Doctor Who still going strong. You know, now you're deeply entrenched in nerd culture. Is that something that you can still take back to them and be like, "Hey, mom, you remember this thing?"
A little bit. My mom doesn't really remember a whole lot about Doctor Who. She didn't really keep up with it when it came back with the Ninth Doctor. But she does have a car that she calls the TARDIS. And, you know, she has like a bunch of Doctor Who stickers on it, and around the license plate it says car is a TARDIS. And so it's got like all this, it's got some pretty cute Doctor Who stuff in there.
When did you start getting into games?
I started getting into games more so with my cousins, like when we would go over to see them, because they had the Atari, they had Nintendo, like I would play Duck Hunt with them, and I would watch them play Mario and like different pinball games on their. I didn't have a console myself until I was in college, but I started playing PC games in high school that my classmates introduced me to.
And what were you playing on that? What was your high school PC experience?
My high school gaming experience was a game called Utopia. It used to be hosted by Swerve.com. Now it's its own website, but it hasn't really, from what I checked, a couple months ago, it hadn't really grown all that much past what it was in high school. Like, it used to be this big thing with like IRC channels and servers, and there was like a fan site dedicated to it where all the players would meet and connect and, you know, just chat. And it's like, wow, everything on there has been dead for a couple of years.
D&D and tabletop games are making a comeback, so who knows what we'll see in the next couple of years.
That's true, but to me, D&D is kind of a little bit more towards the role-playing adventure side of things rather than strictly text-based.
Do you have any D&D experience?
I do. I've been a couple of campaigns. Unfortunately, due to scheduling conflicts with a lot of the members, neither one of them really was able to get very far. But yeah, it was a lot of fun.
I think that is the number one issue right now with tabletop games, because I think once you get to be a little older, like when you're in high school, you have all the time in the world to play tabletop games. But then when you're an adult and you have a job or you have a family, it's like you have to make time for those kind of things. And especially if you're not in the same city or country, even, that can be so difficult.
Yeah, everyone in my last D&D group was like two time zones ahead of where I am, because I'm West Coast and they were Central. So it was very difficult, because it was like, oh, you know, I have to do this like early in the evening because, you know, it's 2 hours later for them. And that means that right after we finish each session, they're going to bed.
Yes, so my first experience with D&D, like my first official experience, not watching anything like that, but actually playing, was as a DM, and I was very, how do I put this, ambitious in that I tried to make a homebrew in which we had a magical girl setting in like a fantasy world. They got into that world by teleporting through an arcane machine into the fantasy setting that was in the arcane machines. They were like in the world of the video game, you know, that old chestnut.
That sounds pretty cool.
It was a fun idea, but it was my first time DMing, so it didn't go that well. And I had four players, no, five players. Two of them were in Canada, and the other three were on the West Coast, and I am on the East Coast, so we're all in different time zones, and it was just a hassle to schedule. Outside of playing D&D, do you have any thoughts on the resurgence of things like Critical Role, actual play podcasts, and other tabletop experiences?
I think it's really great, honestly, because I've always been one for inclusion in geek culture and, you know, helping people to understand that it's something that can connect everybody and not, you know, isolate and separate us so much. And I think that the whole gatekeeping thing with it has been really ridiculous.
Yes, it's been so fabulous to see that world open up to everyone. I love that. I mean, I've been watching Critical Role for a while now, and the fact that they have a whole slew of different people come on is so wonderful. And the fact that you can go and find, for instance, I would recommend Queens of Adventure is an actual play podcast done by a group of drag queens, and it is fantastic. I love it. But I think that speaks to the kind of inclusion that we have now in these tabletop games.
Yes, it does, and I definitely want to check this out now.
It is fabulous, as fabulous as you'd imagine. I would like to ask about your thoughts on the Blizzard franchise, because we spoke on it a bit earlier, how you played World of Warcraft, you got into it in college, and now you're doing cosplays, and now you're running Twitters about it. But is it just World of Warcraft? What else are you into?
I do play a little bit of Heroes of the Storm. It's been a while since I've actually really like had the chance to play because of everything else going on, but I really enjoy that game. It was actually Heroes of the Storm that got me into esports, which is something else that I'm really passionate about and I love it. And I enjoy Diablo. I love climbing the ladder, especially during seasonal. I love the storyline of it. And I've actually asked Blizzard on more than one occasion on Twitter, you know, can we please get a recipes from Sanctuary cookbook for Diablo? Because I think that would be really, really interesting. Because I have the Warcraft one. I have the Hearthstone one. The author of those has mentioned that she would love to do a Diablo one as well. I'd really like to see Blizzard do that. And I do like following competitive Overwatch. I don't play it myself. And StarCraft is pretty fun as well.
That would be such an interesting recipe booklet. You'd have things like Hellfire Chicken Wings.
Yes. Yes.
Well, tell me a bit about your love of esports. Because I'll tell you, I played Overwatch a bit, but I really started caring about, like, the meta and the heroes and things like that when I started getting into competitive Overwatch and watching the league. And I've even, you know, flown out there to see them play at the arena, which, you know, for me is quite a trek. That's something that really helped me understand the kind of, like, team sports, passion around team sports. So I'm curious as to what your view on esports is.
I love esports personally. The first esports event that I really attended was the America's Championship in 2015 for Heroes of the Storm, which took place here in Las Vegas over Labor Day weekend. I was going because I had some friends who were going to be there. I really wanted to see them, you know, maybe just kind of hang out. I played Heroes very casually at the time. I've never really been one to try and play competitive Heroes myself in Hero League and try and climb that ladder. It's just not really my scene. But I found myself over the course of the 2 days there becoming really invested in like the teams and the players and wanting to see them succeed. And just, I remember calling my parents after and talking to my dad and being like, Dad, I get why you yell at the TV when football's on now. You know, like, I found my thing, my sports thing. I found it. And so I love like video games and open nerd culture is now in general. Like, I love esports. I love being part of it. I run the social media accounts for an esports organization. And I love interacting with our players, and they call me mom, pretty much, you know, and just, like, being able to cheer them on and help build them up and build up and, you know, help them kind of reach out to any fans that they have and build their brands as well. It's just, it's so much fun. I absolutely love doing it.
What are some interesting things that you've come across in that job? Because you talk about, you know, reaching out to the fans and interacting in that way. Something that struck me when I started watching the Overwatch League was that these people, and a lot of esports players are quite young, not all of them, but a fair majority, and to see them kind of rise in popularity and then maybe not have this filter or way to handle that and handle the social media experience of that sudden attention has been something that's been really interesting to watch. But also, I feel like Blizzard maybe should provide someone that helps guide them through that. How are you handling that sort of interaction in your experience as a social media manager for any sports company?
That is definitely something that we have also run into with a couple of our players in the past. And it's something that I really feel that Blizzard or any gaming company that, has esports franchises within their titles, it's something that they really should be doing or have guidelines set up, be like certain things that they should and should not be doing, or, just behavior. There's a few instances that I can't really speak about in detail, but there have been a couple times when players from my organizations have posted things on Twitter and other social media places, and I'm like, hey, you really can't say that because it's going to reflect poorly on you. It's going to reflect poorly on the organization, and you're becoming somebody popular. You're in the spotlight. You need to watch what you say and do now. And you need to remember that and understand that.
And I feel like that's such a it's a touchy subject, and I appreciate you speaking on it at all. I feel like, I've discussed this a bit on stream with my co-host Ziomara, because we do an Overwatch broadcast, and we've talked a bit about, well, who is the onus on, right? Is it on Blizzard to provide them that? Is it on the owners of the team to provide them that person that's going to kind of help them deal with the sudden rise in popularity? I certainly feel like, these players should at least have a team therapist. I feel like they should have a PR person that kind of helps them out, because you just don't know. Like, as anyone between 18 and like 30, and maybe even 30 and beyond, but definitely in those years, sometimes you just don't know how to act. And I feel like having someone for the express purpose would be really helpful. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that part of it should be on Blizzard because, it is their game and it is going to reflect on their game community in general. But I also feel like, in a professional setting like Overwatch League, for example, especially, at that level, it's up to the owners to, have someone on staff or to make sure that they discuss with their players what is and is not acceptable. Maybe even write it into their contract if it's going to be, if they are worried it's going to be that much of a problem. But having someone on your staff, and if it's someone who doesn't have that role specifically, like if you have a social media director or communications director, make sure that you're all on the same page. And that you're willing to sit down with your player and be like, hey, this isn't okay, or you need to miss some more. Don't be like, that's wrong and you shouldn't be doing that. Just be like, hey, yes, blows up in your face. We need to rectify this. Or just be like, hey, we learned from this. Let's going forward try and do better.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like they could only benefit from having that sort of environment. I think there's a lot that we learned in Overwatch League Season 1. And I'm not going to turn this into Overwatch League analysis, what went wrong and what went right. But I think for the purposes of talking about social media management, which is something that you do, I think that definitely they should have someone, and I agree with your stance. Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome. I've also dealt with like Call of Duty players and WoW players and now Rainbow Six Siege players. So they're just kind of all over the spectrum because each company is obviously going to have a different stance about what they will and will not tolerate.
Well, how is this something you got into? How did you end up becoming a social media manager for an esports company? Because that's always something that, I wistfully look at the like job listings for different game industry jobs, or the Blizzard hiring page and whatnot, and go, well, what am I qualified for? How did you end up in this position?
I actually applied for a social media internship at Method because I follow them quite a bit, not just for their WoW and now for their Heroes, but for their other games and everything. Unfortunately, my application was declined, but I was very fortunate that my information ended up in the hands of the owner of an organization called Rockets Esports, which I ended up being with for almost a year. I was running their social media, I was helping do marketing, I was starting to step into merchandising and their management when the organization disbanded. But it was just one of those things where, like, the position I have now, I approached the owners because I had already had almost a year of experience, and I was introduced to them and I was like, hey, I really think I might be a good fit for your organization, and here's what I can do for you. Let's sit down, have an actual meeting and talk. And they're like, okay, cool. So that's where I am now. But if you're looking to just start in esports or like social media for esports or anything like that, Hitmarker Jobs thing, they have listings constantly for social media positions, marketing, all sorts of things from volunteer to paid full-time positions at esports organizations and companies. And for a lot of them, especially for the social media for esports orgs, you don't need to have experience. But getting the experience at a new org, helping it grow, starting it up, things like that, it is definitely good for your resume. Even if you just have like two, don't. This is one thing that always bugs me when people apply to be a staffer at my organization. Do not try and run social media or anything for more than one organization at a time. It looks unprofessional. I understand why a lot of people do it. They do it because they're just so eager for that experience, but at some point in the future, it could become a potential conflict of interest between those organizations. So I unfortunately end up turning away a lot of people who either run their own esports org, or they do social media, or they do something else at another org. Fortunately, I don't want to potentially put my org at risk for that conflict. But, it's hard. It's definitely hard. There's a lot of hustle involved. You just got to put yourself out and make those connections. Get out on social media for yourself personally as well will definitely help.
And not only are you doing this esports role with your social media management, you're also a Twitch partner, a Discord partner, you work for Bebo, and you do all these different things. You wear so many different hats. How do you manage all that and have a social life?
I don't have a social life. That's my secret. No, really. I work 5 days a week for Bebo. That is my full-time job, and I do a lot of social media stuff. It's pretty exhausting. I do take time for myself mostly on the weekends or, before work to do what I can and things like that. It's a very full plate, but I figured out how to make it work.
I'd love to know a little bit about your Twitch experience. How did you start streaming? What motivated you to start broadcasting your life to the world?
I don't like broadcast my life to the world, just more of my gaming and cosplay stuff. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in my life that isn't on social media, but that's how I like it. I started streaming because when I was a kid, I used to do the mathathons for St. Jude Research Hospital. And in 2014, I think it was 2014 or 2015, it was 2015, I heard about the Play Live, which is their game-a-thon thing that goes on around, but prize season is for like this 1 month period. And I was like, hey, I used to do mathathons for them. Oh, I can play video games for them and help raise money? I'm gonna do that. So I started streaming. Originally, for I think the first couple years, it was only during the St. Jude prize season, because I wanted to raise the money for them. And then I was like, I actually kind of like doing this. So last year, I started just kind of streaming more video games. Now, more what I focus on. And some Stardew Valley and Final Fantasy IV here and there. Yeah, just whatever.
Oh man, Stardew Valley. Oh.
I think I have like 800 hours in that game.
It is so good, so time consuming. Have you married anyone?
I have married Elliot and Sebastian in two separate save files. Next, I am going to go for I forget her name, the purple-haired girl.
Abigail or Emily? I
Yes,
think there's two. Okay.
Abigail. Yeah, Emily has the blue hair. I'm going for Abigail next time.
Yes, Abigail is my first wife. She is so wonderful.
I am very excited to romance her.
I'm gonna tell you, she loves amethyst, so that's a good way to go.
All right, I'll make note of that.
You've been streaming a lot, as we've talked about a little bit, a lot of cosplay recently, and I want to know when you got into cosplaying. When did you start cosplaying?
I started cosplaying back in 2007. The first costume I ever made was a Slytherin cloak for the Harry Potter final book release. At the time, based on everything in the books and movies, nobody really paid attention to Hufflepuff or Ravenclaw. So we were always like, oh yeah, I'm either Ravenclaw or Slytherin, because nobody else be, anything else. I was like, oh, I don't want to be Gryffindor. I'm going to be an edgy, cool kid and go with Slytherin. Took every quiz I've taken has always told me I'm a Ravenclaw, so I've learned to embrace that. But really awfully made cloak. It was, oh gosh. I was shocked it didn't fall apart as I was wearing it.
I will say that you may not have been that far off. You know, Slytherins and Ravenclaws, they're very close. They're a good
It's
pair.
true. It's true, yeah. Yeah, just how they go about achieving the ends to their means is very different.
Do you think you learned anything from that first cosplay?
Yes. I learned a lot from that first cosplay. I learned that I really, really hate cutting patterns and pinning fabric. I just like the sewing part. And so get those first two parts over with as fast as I can. And that hemming things is an absolute nightmare.
I think hemming things is the only thing I know how to do. At 4'11", let's say pants aren't often my length.
I completely understand. I'm only 5 feet. I totally get it.
So as you've continued cosplaying, I'm sure you've learned a wealth of information. Can you give us a little bit of your cosplay history and maybe a couple of the outfits that you've put together that have really stood out to you or been your favorite to do?
Oh gosh. Yeah, 'cause I mean, there's been a lot, 'cause I've been sewing since I was about 10 years old. So by the time I got into cosplay, I'd already been sewing for about 11 years. And sewing a stuffed animal in middle school home economics class is very different than sewing a garment. Oh, man. So yeah, I just the ones that stand out to me the most were the first costume I ever made using that had beading, and it was the first one that I ever had embroidery on, machine embroidery, not hand embroidery. And it took me, I want to say, almost 6 months. Definitely don't rush through your costume when you're constructing it. Doing a mock-up with really cheap fabric, you do it like two or three times to make sure you get the proper fit, that you get the way you get it looking the way that you want it to look. Like, those things are going to be super, super important when you do, your costumes. But those are also things that will come in time as you craft more and do more cosplay construction. It'll get easier. Definitely give yourself a larger budget than you think you're going to need. So for me, usually I try to put aside like 200 to 300 per costume, depending on what it is. And it always ends up costing me about 500 to 600 at least. I don't do as many costumes as I used to.
That's actually really good advice on the make a bunch of cheap mock-ups, because I feel like maybe newbies might go out and, want to buy all the material for their cosplay at first, and that's a big upfront cost. And then if you make mistakes on that, you've really sunk a lot of money into that particular material and you're out of that material.
Yeah. Also, starting off with cheap material to make your costumes is okay. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that because, as you get older and as you work with more materials, it'll be easier to put more money into them, hopefully. And, you'll become more versatile in what you are able to work with. Like when I first started, all I would use was quilting cotton. Like that was pretty much the only fabric I would use. And now I still like to use quilting cotton from time to time, but I know that, okay, well, most of the costumes I make, that's not going to want to use. And it's more like, well, I can use it for this part, but for a majority of this costume, I'll want to use like satin or taffeta, or like a cotton sateen, which is like my favorite thing to wear. I'm using velvet, I've used silk before. It's like those are so hard to work with. Some of those materials are very difficult to work with, and it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of practice. So don't expect to come out with like this, this amazingly beautiful full ball gown of silk. Something with velvet on it. It's gonna take some time and just work at your own pace and it's okay.
Do you have a particular cosplay that you've done that has been received the best, that's gotten the most positive feedback, and were you surprised by that?
There's been a couple. The first one that comes to mind was my Final Fantasy Dissidia Terra costume. That one was the first one I did embroidery on and my first beading. That one is probably one of my most expensive costumes to date because of all the beads. Just everyone was so excited to see it, and it was one that I did as part of a group. It was one of the few group cosplays that I have done, but it was just really well received, and I didn't realize how large the Final Fantasy fandom was until that moment.
The reason I phrased it like that is because I think oftentimes, I have a lot of artist friends, and the artworks that they make that they expect to be popular sometimes aren't as popular as they expect, and the ones that they just do, for their own personal enjoyment really get spectacular feedback. And I think that sometimes you can be surprised by the things that you make and how they're received.
Yeah, it's definitely true for sure. Like, I got a lot more positive feedback on that than I have for like Aerith, my Aerith costumes, because I've done quite a number of those because she's usually my go-to girl for Final Fantasy. And I've gotten a lot of positive feedback on them, but Terra got a lot more than Aerith did. But I think that's because there's this huge, just bubble of people who feel that six is the best Final Fantasy game out there. So
Well, do you want to tell me a bit about Final Fantasy and what it has meant to you, or how long you've played it, or what kind of role it's sustained in your life?
Final Fantasy VII was actually my first console game that I ever owned myself. It opened up the entire world of cosplay to me, and I actually wrote a whole article about it for D20 Crit. As soon as they announced, I think it was 4 years ago now, 3 or 4 years ago, at E3, that they were going to be remaking Final Fantasy VII, I just remember just crying because I was so happy. Because I've been waiting for that since the 10th anniversary. I've been waiting for that announcement since we got Crisis Core. And I love the Final Fantasy franchise as a whole. Is that version of like the fantasy genre just really resonates with me with what I grew up. Obviously, not all of them are the same kind of feel. Like Final Fantasy X was a huge departure with a lot of that stuff, but yeah, just Final Fantasy, just everybody's like, oh, I know Blizzard is so much to you and wow and everything like that. It's like, it does, but at the same time, Final Fantasy just means that much more. It's always just like the core of who I am as a nerd and a geek, more so even than Blizzard has. I have literally almost every single Final Fantasy game, starting with the original PlayStation ones. I think the only ones I don't have are 13 and 13-2, because I just didn't like them. And so I was just like, I don't want to keep these.
What exactly is it about that series, about that franchise that appeals to you?
Sure. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that it was my first series, and it was the first console series that I ever owned on my own. Like I mentioned earlier, I had watched people play Mario games, I'd played Duck Hunt, but for me, I think it was more just the fact that Final Fantasy VII had like this storyline and had cutscenes, and that was stuff that I wasn't seeing when I was 5 or 6 years old.
Oh, that's so beautiful. It's like you grew up on Final Fantasy. Well, grew up, but you grew up in your nerddom in Final Fantasy. So for you, it's like your like something you play as a child. Like for instance, for me as a kid, I played Pokemon, and that's something that I still have. Every Pokemon game I'm excited about. Every time they announce something for Pokemon, I am excited about it because that's something that meant a lot to me.
And like Final Fantasy VII was how I discovered cosplay, because I imagine there were a lot of people who did this, but when I first got into it, I would have like these folders dedicated to just fan art of all the Final Fantasy VII characters, and I eventually came across cosplayers. And I was like, what? What is this? This is so cool. Oh my gosh, people actually like make these outfits to look like these characters. What? There's conventions for this? It's like it blew my mind because it was like on a totally different level than just, thinking about it and role playing them on like LiveJournal and writing fan fictions and different things like that.
What has your experience been? I mean, obviously, as a cosplayer, you go and do your cosplay, but what has been your con going experience as a whole?
My very first convention, I actually went to Anime Boston 2008, and I went to every single Final Fantasy panel that they had there. Like, 'cause I was like, oh my gosh, Final Fantasy panels, I can meet other fans. And there was this one, like Final Fantasy and Philosophy, and it was just the worst. I was a really like hardcore into Final Fantasy at the time, more so than I am now. But like going to this panel and just like hearing these guys talk, I was like, what? You're considered experts on this? No, you're just like everything about what they were saying was so wrong. And I actually ended up leaving the panel, sat outside and talked to this girl who is now my best friend. Even though she lives in Dubai, like she's been my best friend since that day. And I never would have met her, and it's also kind of how I met my roommate. We were first introduced when she came into where I worked, because I worked at a bookstore at the time, And she was reading manga, and I was like all excited because, hey, you're into manga. Let's be weebs together, you know, little weeaboos. And she's like, yeah, I'm going to Anime Boston. I'm like, hey, me too. What are you cosplaying? And she was like, oh, I'm going to cosplay Reno from Final Fantasy VII. I'm like, I'm going to cosplay Aerith. I'm going to find you. And then we found out we went to college together, and 10 years later, she's my roommate and one of my other best friends. But yeah, back then I would go to like every single panel that I could, and now it's more I go to like see my friends. I still go to panels once in a while, but I prefer to participate in panels rather than watch them because I have so much more knowledge and experience now. It's like, hey, I really want to share this with other people who might be interested. So to go from, hey, I'm going to meet as many people as possible, to, hey, I'm just going to go see my friends and share my knowledge and put on panels.
What are some of the panels you've done?
I have done convention and cosplay etiquette, just kind of like a basic rundown of things that you should bring to the convention for like what you should pack if you're a cosplayer or even if you're not a cosplayer. What to expect if the first conventions you've ever gone to, how to behave, you know, the 1-3-5 rule, one shower a day, three meals a day, at least 5 hours of sleep every day at a convention. I'm just kind of like breaking that down for people. I've done an artist alley survival for people who are new to selling at the artist alley. Oh gosh, I've done like, I tried to do how to make a cosplay your full-time job panel, but really, even now, don't feel that I was properly qualified for that because cosplay is not my full-time job and it never has been. And I feel like people kind of got the wrong impression. And I feel like it isn't something that I feel comfortable speaking about.
I think that's incredibly helpful to do those kind of panels. Do you think that you could give us like a top three survival tips for conventions?
Yeah, just the 1-3-5 rule, one shower, three meals. Pocky is not a meal. And 5 hours of sleep every night. Don't sardine people in your into your hotel room. Unfortunately, even if that means you end up not being able to go because you can't afford the hotel room, you have limits on like the number of people you can have in a room for a reason. And as for buyer safety codes, it's not because they're being jerks or they just want more money out of you. It is for your personal safety and, you know, liability on the hotel. Wear deodorant. Please, for the love of everything, wear deodorant. If you're wearing a cosplay, iron it. Or if you can't iron it, at least steam it to get the wrinkles out. You can like put it on a hanger in the bathroom so when people shower, the steam will get some of the wrinkles out. Or if the hotel iron, you know, has a steam option, costume looks so much better when you wear it to just like not have all the wrinkles. It will wrinkle during the day. That's just the nature of most costumes, but it won't look as bad as it would if you had not ironed it.
I will tell you that is so funny. I will tell you that the two cosplays that I've done, and yeah, I did too, and I realized that it just really wasn't for me as much as I love, Halloween is a big deal for me. I love it, and I love doing costumes for Halloween, and so I was just like, I'm also a nerd, we can put these two things together. I did a Rachel Alucard from Blaze Blue, which is like this little vampire Lolita girl, and that, my God, was a train wreck. It came out okay because I had my grandmother's help.
Yeah, that's a pretty ambitious costume, especially for like a first costume.
Yeah, and I think the only reason it even sort of came together was because I had my grandmother's help, who is an experienced seamstress, I would say. She really helped me out. But I didn't prepare for the idea of a hoop skirt, or having some sort of way to balance out the skirt. So my answer to that was to have hula hoops and fishing wire, and or like fishing line, and it was not good. But, you know, not a flat dress, because that skirt is supposed to, you know, kind of poof out, whether or not you do that with petty skirts or hoop skirt or whatnot. It was okay, but that was just such like an experience for me. And I did a very casual Morton Salt Girl, but I think the steaming of the outfits or like putting it in the shower is such a fantastic suggestion.
Yeah, because I used to do dance before I got into cosplay, like when I was in like middle school and high school. And one of the ways that we would get co wrinkles out of our costumes, because they were like the really awful cheap polyester, was to put them in the bathroom while you were showering, so that way it would get most of the wrinkles out. So when you were on stage, it would look nice, and it would look nice in photos.
So you did dance. What kind of dance did you do? How did you get into dancing?
Oh gosh. My mom signed me up when I was 3, and I just kept going until I reached high school. I did tap, jazz, ballet. I was also part of like a hip hop technique class from a professor who had graduated from Juilliard, and I did point for 2 years before ankle injuries prevented me from continuing.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, it's okay. It was one of the best things that ever happened to me.
Oh, please elaborate on that statement.
We had a Ukrainian professional ballerina as our technique teacher, and you know, being short and not extremely slender in my teens, even though I was rather tiny, she told me that I would never be a professional ballerina, and it absolutely broke my heart. And then, you know, a couple of years later, after studying point for 2 years, the doctors looked at my ankles and were like, okay, well, you can either doing ballet and completely screw up your ankles even worse than you already have, or you can quit now and, you know, prevent surgery in the future. So I opted to quit and prevent surgery in the future.
Oh, that's such a heartbreaking thing for someone who is supposed to be teaching you and lifting you up to say.
Yeah.
Do you think that kind of stopping that hobby or stopping that, I don't even want to say a hobby, but so, you know, stopping that thing that you did, helped you move into this other phase of your life where you got into games and esports and this other nerdy part of your life?
I think somewhat did. After I quit dance, when I was in high school, I ended up joining the school drama club, which was where, you know, I met other nerds and geeks who were not just into theater, but they were also into gaming, and that's how I learned about D&D and, you know, how I got into the nerdy things that I'm into now. So, like I said, it was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me.
Oh my gosh, the drama club, that's the hot place to be. People don't know. They think drama club is for a bunch of
Bunch of
losers.
weirdos.
No. I mean, it may be true. We may be a bunch of weirdos, but we were fun.
Yeah, we were definitely fun for sure.
Well, there's one thing more that I want to ask you about before we end, and I want to know if you had unlimited money and time. What would your dream cosplay be?
Oh, probably would be, surprisingly enough, from an anime, not a video game. It would be Lady Anna Rochford from Le Chevalier d'Eon. She was a fictional lady in waiting to Queen Marie, and there's this one gorgeous purple gown that she has towards the end of the series that has been my dream list for costumes since I saw the anime back in 2008, because it's a rococo gown, and so I want to make it as accurate as possible using a machine, not my hands, but like materials wise and everything, which would mean like silks and brocades and layer upon layer of undergarments and just everything is just, someday I'll do it.
I can hear the like desire to make this lush and gorgeous gown in your voice as you're talking about it. I can tell you really love this.
Yeah, I've been trying to research fabric for so long and I just haven't found anything that I'm happy with yet. So I just keep putting it off.
Is there anything that you've done that comes, I mean, not even not close to that sort of level of detail, but that has been something that was really a challenge for you, like detail wise, that you came through and maybe like learned something about how to level up your cosplay?
I actually try to do that with every costume I make. That's something that I try to do myself is like I want to challenge myself with every single costume. But Terra from Final Fantasy Dissidia, I keep bringing it up, but this one really was like a huge thing for me to level and challenge a. It was my first embroidered costume. It was my first beaded costume. It was the first one where I made about 3/4 of the patterns by hand, not basing them off of any commercial patterns that I modified or anything. And it's something that I'm still really proud of. As well as my Night Elf Druid that I made for BlizzCon in 2014. I made it out entirely out of leather and suede, which, kids, don't do that unless you're very, very experienced with leather working. Don't do it. I probably should have just stuck to, fabrics that I was more comfortable with working with instead of being like, hey, my wear, make this out of all leather, make it totally accurate. It ended up being a mess, and I don't recommend it. Just, yeah, those are like the two that stick out to me the most that really helped me level up. Jaina that I'm working on now is helping me level up as well with like armor making and modifying patterns and creating more patterns scratch. So yeah, and I'm also going to be working on sculpting a little bit on this one for some of the armor pieces. So everything I do, I try and do something new and some sort of challenge that I haven't put myself up against before.
We've talked a bit about ironing or steaming your outfits and challenging yourself to do better than the last thing you've done before. But if you had one piece of advice for people just starting out in cosplay, what would it be?
Use your coupons at the fabric store. If you're buying fabric, make sure you use your coupons. Sign up for the mailing list, check the emails, download competitors' coupons because I know Joann Fabrics, Michaels, and I believe Hobby Lobby also takes competitor coupons. Just go in with a shopping list, buy 2 or 3 more yards of fabric than you think you're going to need. Because yes, patterns will tell you, oh, we leave enough room if there's an error, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes they don't leave you as much as you think if you run into a hiccup or something. So, making sure that you have that extra fabric definitely helps.
All fantastic advice. Thank you so much, Serafita, for coming on. It's been a joy talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me on. I love sharing my information. I'm always open to helping people, if they come to me with questions.
If anyone has a question for you, where can they find you on social media?
They can find me on Twitter at Serafita or on Twitch at Serafita if I'm streaming. But usually my Twitter is probably the best way to get a hold of me. My DMs are open if they don't want to ask publicly. I try to respond to most tweets that I get when I see them.
All right, and I'm going to put all your links below. Thank you again.
And thank you so much.
All right, bye guys.
Bye.